So welcome everyone to this session. I'm Veronica Taylor from ANU and it's my pleasure to chair and moderate what I think is going to be a really, really interesting series of presentations and discussion. In the conference thus far, we've been thinking a lot about a new paradigm for aid delivery. In particular, we've been hearing from the World Development Report and from Michael Wilcox's keynote address about the need to do things differently, to be more iterative, to be more experimental. And another term that recurs often in these conversations is locally led. So this session is an exploration of what local actor-led policy development looks like in the Indonesian context. And we're going to hear from three speakers who each represent leading reform civil society organisations in the fields of health, justice and poverty reduction, who are currently being supported by the DFAT-funded Knowledge Sector Initiative. The Knowledge Sector Initiative, KSI, is an attempt by DFAT to be innovative and to really mobilise Australian aid so as to link up the private sector through policy reform, civil society organisations, NGOs and policy institutes with their counterparts in government. The overarching aim of KSI is to try to nourish evidence-based policymaking in Indonesia and to really bring knowledge to policy. And our speakers represent some of the organisations and partners in that initiative who are the conduits for that research data and for that knowledge to policy process. So we'll hear today from Luhur Arif Bima from the Smeru Research Institute talking about the process of poverty policy formulation in Indonesia and the current state of play then. We'll then go to Agita Putri representing PSHK, a leading law reform CSO. And Gita is presenting how development policy is being reconceived in Indonesia using the example of the Supreme Court judicial reform agenda. And then we'll close with Sita Listadewi Widodo from PKMK at University of Gajah Mada, talking about the process of building capacity for decision-maker-led implementation research in Indonesia, but with a very deep focus on the rollout of universal health care. We have plenty of time for questions and discussions in this session, so I'll turn now and invite Bima to kick us off. Thank you.
Thank you, Veronica. Yeah. Good morning, everyone. It is an honor for me to be here. And I am here as a representative of the Smeru Research Institute. My institute has received core funding from DFAT for more than 10 years. And we use the core funding to improve the organization capacity in improving the staff competency so that we can deliver or conducting high quality research. And we use the findings of our research to provide input to the government in the process of policy making. And today, I will use this opportunity to share one of our experience in working together with the government. In this specific case is we collaborated with the government in formulating anti-poverty policy. So the issue is that the government in Indonesia has spent a huge amount of money. In 2010, based on the calculation, the government spent about almost 20 billion Australian dollar only for programs related to the poverty reduction programs. It is about 10% of its national budget. However, the impact of this program still lower than the expectation. The poverty reduction rate becomes lower and slower every year. This is because several factors. One of them is the external factors because of the slowdown of the global economy influencing the Indonesian economy. and also the internal factors in which that the poverty problem in Indonesia is about the core poverty. It is about the poorest of the poor, in which that the issue is much more complicated. But also another internal factors that make the poverty program effort is the impact of the poverty program is lower than the expectation is because the programs are administered scattered in many agencies. And in these situations, the impact of the program is lower. So that because of this condition, we need an initiative in order to lift the impact of the efficiency and the efficiency of the spending on the poverty reduction. Therefore, the government collaborated with my institution. We tried to formulate a policy in order to integrate all programs that related to the poverty issue, the poverty reduction effort, into one integrated master plan, in which that we try to introduce a new approach where before the program focus only on the how to implement the target, but in this new master plan, we try that a new paradigm that the program should be based on what the people, the poor needs. So the process of the policy making, the master plan for the poverty reduction acceleration start in 2011. The short story behind that is that in 2010, the president of Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono launched a master plan for economic development acceleration. But after some while, there are some criticism because the master plan is neglecting the poor, excluding the poor. As a response, the government asked the Ministry of the Planning and Development Agency, which is known as Bappenas, to develop a master plan for poverty reduction acceleration as a complement of that the previous of the other master plan. Story about Bappenas. Before the reform order under the President Suharto's regime, Bappenas has an important role in the country development. But when the reform start, its role become less and less because the role of Ministry of Finance become more powerful. But when President Jokowi came into office, his plan is to make the Bappenas as a lead of the planning, development planning in Indonesia, and then Bappenas in the process of making anti-poverty policy, Bappenas appointed Semeru to lead the process, and then so we, the institution, working together with the Bappenas in order to draft the document. We have a regular or a series of discussion in order to develop it, and also then we also share the draft in order to consult it to various stakeholders, not only the national stakeholder, but also the regional and also non-governmental stakeholders, such as the private sector, the NGOs, and also the academic members. And after 1.5 years, finally the document submitted to the government. However, actually the government has never made this document as a formal document. But the Bappenas was able to adopt the strategies in the master plan and put it as part of the national medium-term development plan. And also the document, although it didn't become a formal document, government document, many agencies, many ministries adopt the strategies in order to design programs that use to alleviate poverties. So probably from my explanation, it sounds the process is very smooth. It just follow the policy cycle model. But actually, based on our experience, there are some important issue that should be considered in the future in order to improve the involvement of NGO or the think tank organization in the process of policy making in the context of Indonesia. One important issue is that in order to be a counterpart of the government in the policy process making, the NGO, the think tank organization should have a good reputation and also capability in order to be a counterpart of government. Smeru develops its capacity by doing research in order to obtain accumulated knowledge, and the research mostly funded by donors. For example, for the USAID, and also from the World Bank. And also one important thing is that the organization also should invest on their human resources, the researcher in that institution, so that the researcher can deliver high quality research. Not so many think tank organizations in Indonesia are able to do that because of the financial resource limitation. And that's why there is a need for another external resource, financial resource, in order to help the institution, the think tank organization in Indonesia to develop their capacity. So that is the aspect from the think tank organization. And another critical issue in making a good collaboration between think tank and government is how the think tank engages with the government. Because what we learn from the process having interaction with the government is that it's not always about the idea that we deliver to them, but also how it is delivered. Because sometimes, even if we have a very good ideal idea, very best, probably the best approach, something that, but if we cannot present it properly or properly to the government, they might be resistant from the government in order to accept the idea. So it should be the think tank should be able to develop a long-term relationship with the government through various activities, both formal and informal. There should be a good communication and constructive discussion. For example, Smeru did many activities in order to build relationship with the government. We did many seminars. We also have a formal or informal meeting with the governments in order to provide input to them when they ask for it. And also we also sometimes we provide technical assistance to help them when they need some assistance. The important things is that we should able to have a constructive discussion, because sometimes the government might have different idea with what we want to propose, but through this constructive discussion, step by step, then the government can accept the idea. And another thing is that we should also understand the political context of the policy and also the interest and need of the government. In this case, the think tank also should be able to come up with alternative scenarios when we provide inputs to them. Because we cannot only just provide one scenario that probably is the best one, but it may not fit to the government needs. For example, when we developed the document, the master plan for the poverty reduction acceleration, from our perspective, the programs, the anti-poverty program, should be administered under one institution in order to make it more efficient and also have to have a bigger impact on the poor people. However, we also should understand that there is a conflict of interest between political parties in the ministry. So that's why that we cannot push this idea. Then we have to come up with another alternative scenarios, although it's not the best one, but we also have to understand what the context in the government. We have to also be able to provide another scenarios that may fit to what they need. And also another to make what idea that our idea can be accepted by the government. And in process of policy making, there is an important role of aid support, because I use this diagram to explain how the aid from donors help the interaction between NGO, the think tank, and government. In low-income countries, usually where the government have limitation in financial capacity in infrastructure development, aid support usually come directly to the infrastructure development and also to the NGO of the community development in order to improve the infrastructure, for example, public services. But when the country shifted from the low income to the middle income, and the government and the government have more capability in building in developing the country, there also a change from the chain of intervention in the aid in the donors. There will be more technical assistance to the government, and also the donor also help to strengthening the think tank organization in order to have more sustainable support to the government. Because the drawback of direct technical assistance is that because it is only in the assistance only in a short period, and sometimes because the duration is very short, the foreign expertise, the foreign expert don't have enough time to build a good relationship with the government. And when the assistance end, and also there is nothing left for the government. Probably there is a small impact on the capacity of the government, but probably it's not sustainable. But when the donors try to strengthen in the think tank organization to improve the capacity of think tank organization in order to provide a better make the think tank can provide a better input to the government, then and also that donor help to facilitate the interaction between the government and the think tank, make the government more open to advice or input from the external parties, in this case the think tank, then there will be a more sustainable communication, relationship between these two parties, and it will have a more significant impact rather than other type of intervention. And in this case, KSI play its role in facilitating the communication between the think tank organization and the government. It helps the think tank to provide to have a better communication with the government. So, as a conclusion of the process that we have done, my institution have done, is that the good policy making requires intensive collaboration and also a very good constructive discussion with the government, and it can be done through a formal and informal engagement, and also intensive collaboration, a long term relationship between a think tank and the government will also create the need for evidence, the need for research finding from the government side. And it means that there will be a sustainable or long-term relation between these two parties. And the think tank also need should be able to translate the finding because probably in developing countries, the governments, agencies cannot directly adopt the research finding in order to custom the findings to their needs, to practical needs. So it means that think tank organizations should have skills to translate their findings in form that easily can be adapted by the government. And think tank also should have understanding about the political context of the policy in order to provide more appropriate input to the government and can be accepted by the government. And the conclusion of the role of development aid is that donors' aid is important to help think tank to develop its sustainability by making accumulated knowledge through research. Because then the think tank will have a better skill to provide a better high quality research and then become a more reliable and trusted organization for the government. And it helps the think tank to disseminate knowledge through various activities. And one important thing that donors also help to bridge the communication between government and NGOs in order to maintain or to develop a more sustainable collaboration between government and NGOs in the future. So that's all my presentation. Thank you very much.
Hello everyone, my name is Gita, I'm from Jakarta. My presentation I'm about to make is about evidence-based policy led by research institution in the justice sector reform in Indonesia. Beforehand, we have to know first about the context of justice sector reform in Indonesia. During the Suharto era, from 1967 to 1998, the Indonesian Supreme Court was not a transparent and progressive institution. Cases from the first instance court could spend years up to the Supreme Court, and decisions by the Supreme Court could be intervened by the executives during these times. And the court did not see its role as providing answers for justice seekers. And after 1998, the Supreme Court began to open up, and the court became more transparent. But the 32 years under the Suharto regime becomes one of the burden for the court, the challenge for them, for the court, is to make the public trust the court more. And I have to add, during the Constitution amendment in 2001, one of the articles being amended was about the Supreme Court. One of the initiatives after 1998, under Bagirmanan, one of the chief justices, is the Supreme Court opened themselves and responded to the challenge by engaging with civil society institution. In 2003, they established the Supreme Court Blueprint. It marks the involvement of civil society organization in Supreme Court. And the court become more transparent, and since then, all the decisions back from the colonial eras and up until now are already being published in the Supreme Court websites. But since the Supreme Court becoming more transparent, their problems and challenges become to appear. These are the current status of the Indonesian Supreme Court. There are 16,000 cases. Has to be decided by the 52 justices of the Supreme Court. It leaves thousands of pending cases for the upcoming year. Despite the thousands of cases, it is a rise from previous years. Previously, The pending cases are more than 3,000, but in 2016, the pending cases are becoming more fewer. The backlog of cases exhausts all the resources in the Supreme Court and also in the first instance court. Rather than allocating their energy for better quality of decisions, the Supreme Court focusing more on managing, on how to manage the backlog of cases. These are some of the examples of where the Supreme Court starts to work together with civil society organizations like mine. Since the Supreme Court are becoming more transparent, they found that out of 3 million cases in the first instance court, 96% of 3 million cases are from traffic violations. And you can see here people are queuing in the, I believe this is in West Java's first instance court, where you see people are queuing to have their traffic tickets being handled by the judge. By the court. The first, by addressing the court realized that this is one of the problem in the first instance court, and they tried to seek the answers. And one of the first collaboration within my organization with the Supreme Court was in 2013. The court wanted to make a survey from the public on how the first instance on how they engage with the public. And they conducted a survey in 12 provinces in Indonesia, and they found out that not many people are very pleased with the court performance, and most of them who are not pleased with the court service are about traffic cases management in the first instance court. And in 2013, my organization, working together with the supervisor unit in the Supreme Court, conduct the research and draft issuance regulation of the Supreme Court on how to handle traffic management system. And in Indonesia, the law enforcement agencies are sometimes still have. It's not secret that they still have their rent-seeking behavior. And the police patrol the streets all the time, and they try to catch people who are violating the traffic rules. Sometimes they look for the ones who are not carrying their papers, or looking for the ones who are not wearing helmets. And these are the people who are going to court because they don't want to bribe the police. So the police, so these people are saying to the police, I prefer to go to the court rather than bribe you. So these are the good ones you see here. And you can see the judge here has to decide, no room crammed full of people. And these people are waiting days, mostly waiting for like more than 3 hours just to get in line. And this situation is very common in urban cities, in big cities in Indonesia. Another project my institution work together with the Supreme Court is on the small claims court. We try to draft and make conducting workshops with justices, with judges, on how to regulate cases for disputes not exceeding $20,000. To be handled not more than 3 months. Usually for disputes like this, it could go for more than 3 months, could go up to years. And with this new regulation, these kind of cases should not exceed 3 months within the first instance court. Learning from these just samples, the recent samples of how my organization collaborate and conducting research with the Supreme Court, and from these experiences, my organization learns that there are many ways to engage with the Supreme Court in the justice sector reform, and some of these three ways are, oops, And we engage policymakers, in this case the Supreme Court, in a joint policy research study. So we help them to conducting workshop. We provide data for them, and we, some of the cases, we try to draft their internal regulation. But working together with the Supreme Court does not make us in a position that not critical to them. As an NGO, we also relate to other who have more an advocacy group to play a critical role to the Supreme Court. We form an alliance of Judiciary Watch organization, and we give statement, press release to the public on how some matters should be addressed by the court. And aside from engaging with other NGOs, we think that the knowledge we possessed after several years in the justice sector reform, the knowledge we collected, we should transfer it to the younger generation. So in 2011, my organization established the Indonesia Jentera School of Law, and we've been running for 2 years. We have 38 students at the moment, 38 law students. Most of them are from remote areas from Indonesia, where we could transfer the knowledge to make them the next generation for justice sector reform. These are the programs I mentioned to you are, the three programs I mentioned to you are supported by the DFAT unit, Australia-Indonesia Partnership of Justice. And these are the programs. And also my institution received fundings from the Knowledge Sector Indonesia, the core funding. And the difference, how my organization relates with these different type of funding is, when with the AAPJ, we conducting programs, but with the funding from the KSI, we try to elevate the conversation. We try to engage with the public using the flexibility these budget gave to us. So you can see here that we have a foreign lecturer. His name is Sebastian Pompe. He's an expert on Indonesian Supreme Court. He gave a lecture to a room full of audience where the flexibility the KSI fund gave to us. We conduct these kind of lectures quite often, and usually we invited the public, but mostly to law students from other campuses in Jakarta. And in conclusion, as one of the actors in the justice sector reform, the Supreme Court is one of the most transparent institutions in Indonesia, despite it is still a baby step for the justice sector reform. And the Supreme Court is still far from perfect. If you Google the news on the Supreme Court and corruption, you can find that last year the Secretary of the Supreme Court was being held as a suspect in a corruption case by the Anti-Corruption Commission. The institution is still far from perfect, and despite that, despite working with them, my organization also urged the Supreme Court Chief of Justice in public, asking him to revoke the person out of his position. And the second one, the Supreme Court involvement in civil society involvement in the Supreme Court reform represents a dramatic change in Indonesian reform. Other institutions like the Attorney General and the Police Force has not been as much as developed as the Supreme Court at the moment. And last but not least, none of this could have happened without sustained support from our partners, not just the donors, but also from the government itself, and also from the specific institution itself. Because despite all the budget, if the institution itself does not want to open themselves to the public, to the GSO, none of this would have happened. Thank you.
Hi everyone, my name is Sita, and I'm the person who stands between you and your lunch. So I'll be quick. I hope so. Yes, I'm from the Center for Health Policy and Management at the Faculty of Medicine, University of Gajah Mada in Yogyakarta. So we are talking about universal health coverage, and the question is, why is universal health coverage in Indonesia is important to you? Maybe to us it's important. So Indonesia is a very complex setting. It has thousands of islands, much of them are populated, and there are a huge variety in terms of health delivery and health outcomes. As you may know, the health status in the eastern part of Indonesia is persistently worse than the western part of Indonesia. And we also have a decentralized governance. It means that there is the central government, and then there's the provincial government as the representative of the central government, and then there's the district government, which is more autonomous. And then the universal health coverage policy aims to cover 250 million more people by 2019, which makes it probably one of the biggest single-payer insurance in the world. Now, UNC is a very complex intervention in Indonesia, particularly because it's a very centralistic policy, so everything is top-down. And it has to interact with so many different actors in a very, varying level of institution and at every different level. So it has to work within so many different set of rules and regulations. It is a very complex funding and payment mechanism, and it has a huge potential for unintended outcomes, which I'm going to talk a bit later on. But this is a point of no return for Indonesia because it's already a political commitment, a political decision that has been made. So it has to be carried out. But it has to be carried out by a lot of bureaucrats and technocrats in the district and in the province. So there are a lot of interpretation in terms of how to work with the universal health coverage policy. And it is a major health financing reform. So we used to have a fee-for-service payment mechanism throughout the country, but now it moves to a prospective payment and claims payment. So it's a huge financial reform. Now, the act itself was actually... The act itself was enacted in 2014 for Social Security, National Social Security System. But the decision to actually implement universal health care coverage was enacted in 2013, and the implementation began in 2014. And as you can see, the policy is still evolving. It has a lot of new and revised regulation on how to implement this policy best. And the administering agency, which called BPJS Kesehatan, it's the National Health Insurance Agency, it's an independent agency. It's directly responsible to the president, so it's a very centralistic agency. This is a very important fact that we need to keep in mind later on. So what is the role of the Center for Health Policy Management where I work? So we work with the Ministry of Health and the National Health Insurance Agency to identify issues in the implementation at the district level. And we use the implementation research methodology, which means that we involve and we engage with all the stakeholders throughout the process of the research. So throughout the identification of problems, developing the instruments, implementing the research, and then discussing the result, and so on and so forth. And by stakeholders, I meant five different departments at the Ministry of Health, the National Health Insurance Agency at the central level and at the regional level, the district health offices, local development planning agencies. We work at the 5 district with 88 health facilities, and we work with 4 research partners, 4 different universities, and the implementation research is conducted in 2 cycles. So the cycle 1 is to identify the challenges in implementing universal healthcare coverage, and the cycle 2 will address these challenges. And I have to mention here that at the moment, we are just finishing cycle 1, so this year we are commencing the cycle 2 part. The research itself is supported by USAID, And KSI provided support in terms of building capacity of translating knowledge into policy. So it's complementing funding. These are the study sites, the five districts that I mentioned. Now, talking about the UHC itself. So the idea is to merge all the existing insurance system and an out-of-pocket payment into a one single pooling social insurance system, which is the National Health Insurance Agency. So the funding came from the national budget, the local budget, and private sectors, including members' premium payment. And the National Health Insurance Agency will pay the primary healthcare facilities and the hospitals in a different way. So for the primary healthcare facilities, the payment is a prospective payment, so capitation. So a number of rupiah per person. And they also have a small amount of non-capitation claim for a small, very small amount. And for the hospitals, they use the case-based package, which we call INACBGs, or Indonesian case-based groups, which means that the hospitals got paid for a certain kind of disease or diagnosis. And the pathway toward the universal coverage, as you can see here, which I mentioned before, was very complicated. So we have the poor and the near poor who are covered by the national government. We have the civil servant policy, a police, the military, and the state-owned enterprises. Each have their own insurance body before. And there is the Jamkasda, local health insurance, which are paid by the local government. These are for the poor and the near poor people in the local level who are not already covered by the national government. We also have small and micro enterprises, and we also have large and medium scale enterprises. So all of these are going to merge into one universal coverage scheme. Now, as you know, and as I mentioned before, the Indonesia has a very decentralized system, which means that the local government has full autonomy, including for the health affairs in their respective district. But the UHC policy is working as a centralized policy and a centralistic agency. So a lot of the regulation is a one-size-fits-all regulation, which makes it difficult, of course, for the local government. For instance, the rates of capitation, the non-capitation claim, and the premium for the UHC is set without considering the characteristic among different regions, which means if you live in Java or if you live in Sumatra, you pay the same thing, and you got paid the same amount of money. There are a lot of different interpretation of the national regulation due to different capacity of the local governments in a way to interpret them into a local regulation. And some of the local government refuse, well, at least until now, they refuse to integrate the local health insurance into UHC due to unequal real benefits, which I'm going to talk a bit later. And again, because the National Health Insurance Agency is a very centralistic body, it refused to share information that they have. So if health facilities reported to the National Health Insurance Agency about the number of patients that goes, the kind of diseases that need to be claimed and all that, those information are not accessible to the local government and to the Ministry of Health, for that matter. Now, the National Health Insurance Agency is currently working on a deficit. Now, it has a 10 trillion rupiah deficit, or 10 million Australian dollar deficit in the first year, and now it's 7 trillion rupiah, or 7 million Australian dollar deficit, and the national government is paying for this. The national government is paying for this, but they now ask that the local government chip in to this single pool and trying to integrate all the local insurance into the national health policy. Now, why is the local government refused to integrate their local insurance into the UHC? Now, this is just one example. The number of facilities in this in this example is a hospital. In this region, region 5, region 6, region 7, which is West Java, Central Java, and East Java, as you can see, the number is the highest in the country. And as you can see, the number of claims in trillion rupiah is also the highest in the country. Region 4 is Jakarta. And the number of claims you can see here is also among the highest. Jakarta is just one city, but it has a lot of specialized hospitals. So a lot of the budget goes to Jakarta and goes to Java. So if you live here in Region 12, which is Papua, although you pay the same premium, although you're entitled to the same benefit package, you cannot access them. So it has a very, very low utilization, a very, very low claim. So with this in mind, the local government are arguing that rather than paying to the universal health coverage poor funding, I'd better keep them and use them to pay the kind of facilities and the kind of supplies that my people need in my local area. So with all these findings that we have from cycle one, we argue that there is a need to strengthen the role of the health facility association, both at the provincial and at the district level, to advocate a more fair premium settings, meaning that different regions should pay different amount of premium. And then we also advocate that we also need to strengthen the district health office and the local government to oversee the USC implementation, including to enable that the information system that the National Health Insurance Agency has is bridged with the local government and the Ministry of Health information system so that they can access the data and they can use it for better planning, of course. And the last point here that I mentioned, there is another issue here, which is the disparity of members' distribution. Which I mean here is at the primary care level, its facility is paid according to the number of the members that are registered in that facility. I'm not sure what happened with the National Health Insurance Agency, what are the policies about this, but in one district, for instance, most of the members are allocated to the public sector, so the public primary health centers. The private clinics or the private primary health centers do not get as much as members as the public sector, although they are located practically next to each other. So the primary health center, the public sector primary health center might have 2,000 members, and the private health center might have 10 members. So the amount of money that they receive are quite different. There's a huge variation in the amounts of money that they receive. But because these are all members of the JKN or on the UHC policy, whether it's public sector or the private sector, they cannot deny patients. They cannot deny access to patients. So because the public sector is so overcrowded, a lot of them are accessing the private private health sector with the USC money, although they actually do not receive the money and they cannot claim all these services that they already provided. So we need to clearly define the regulation on the member redistribution between different health facilities at the district. Now, what are the potential role for international development aid? I think the international development aid can have a major role in terms of addressing the policy and the implementation gap. I think this is one thing that was mentioned also by the keynote speaker on day one. So there needs to be a policy change at the national and at the local government level. But I argue here that changing the policy at the national level might take a longer time than changing the policy at the local level. But we are talking about 400-something different district governments and almost 100 municipality governments. So it's a huge number of local government that needs our support. We also argue that we need to strengthen the learning and exchange of knowledge between the implementers. So what happened was, due to the variety and the capacity of the local government, when we start talking to them, we start telling them about the best practices in different region or different district, they start to get a better knowledge of, oh, we can do this. Oh, we cannot do that. Oh, this is how you do it. So it opens up a whole new of understanding and insights of the implementers at the local level. So I think this is something that we need to also support. We also need to have some capacity building for implementers. So at the moment, a lot of the bulk of the work to do the financial recording and reporting at the primary health center, for instance, are done by nurses and midwives who do not have any kind of financial background or accounting background or knowledge for that matter. So it is a very huge responsibility to take on. We need to build stronger monitoring capacity, including by research institution and university, such as myself. And we need to enable changes in the bureaucratic approach, the top-down approach. This needs to be changed dramatically. And I also argue that we need to build a UHC policy community in Indonesia. So to support the monitoring role of the research institution and university, of course we need to build the capacity of the research institution and university. And what we learned from doing the implementation research methodology, because it is very engaging with the stakeholders, it has a better likelihood that the policymakers are more accepting of all the recommendation and all the dialogue between the policymakers and the advocates. So we need to have a more systematic interaction between the knowledge producer and users, which is in line with the KSI mission, I suppose. And we also have to sustain the ongoing monitoring advocacy. Now, my center, for instance, we have a network of researchers and universities. We have more than 1,000 members of researchers, the health policy researchers, throughout Indonesia from 34 different universities. And we initiate joint research and joint monitoring and evaluation efforts for the UHC. This year, we've done this since 2015. And we also built a community of practice. So these are not just researchers, but these are a combination, a platform where the researcher, the implementers, and the local government can start a dialogue and discuss together the kind of challenges that they have and the kind of solution that they propose. And with that, I thank you very much. As I said, the program was funded by USAID and some part by the KSI. And this is the website where you can, well, it's in Bahasa Indonesia, I'm sorry. This is the website where you can access all the results, the study results, the report, the policy brief, all the kinds of trainings that we have to build the capacity for researchers, and the community of practice forum. Thank you very much.